Welcome, and thank you for standing by. For the duration of today's conference, all parties will have an open line. We ask that during the conference, if you're not speaking, to either utilize your mute feature on your phone or press star six to mute or unmute your line. I'd like to inform all parties that today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I would now like to turn the conference over to Jeffrey Ni. Thank you. You may begin.
All right. Hello, everyone, and welcome. I'm Jeff Ni from the Museum Alliance, the moderator for today's talk. Thank you to all of you for joining us and to anyone listening to the recording in the future. Today, we'll be talking about preparing for the next generation of planetary surface exploration. As a final reminder, as Kurt said, please mute your phones if you're not going to be talking, and do not put us on hold, even if you have to step away because some phones play holding music, which can disrupt the talk. Just be sure your phone is on mute, and we'll be all set to go. The slides for today's presentation can always be found on the Museum Alliance and Solar System Ambassador sites. If you have any problems, you can email me at jnee@jpl.nasa.gov. Our main speaker today is Dr. Kelsey Young. Kelsey graduated with her PhD in geological sciences from Arizona State University. She is part of the Survey RISE team, where she supports the team's goal of incorporating portable geochemical technologies into terrestrial fieldwork in order to prepare for future planetary surface missions. Also on the line is Laura Bleacher, the Solar System Exploration Division's Education and Public Outreach Lead at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center. You can read more about our speakers, as always, on our websites. But for now, I want to get to Kelsey's talk. So, Kelsey, take it away.
All right. Thank you. Thanks for joining us here today. And as this is being recorded, if anybody has questions later that aren't on the line today, my email address is on the last slide of the presentation, so please feel free to email me any questions later. So I'm going to be talking about operational field tests in analog environments, as well as field portable instruments, and the role of incorporating them into the next generation of planetary surface exploration. And I apologize, I didn't put slide numbers on the slides, but I'll indicate when I'm switching to the next slide, which I'll do right now. So the next slide indicates, I just wanted to introduce myself and what I'm going to be talking about. My name is Kelsey Young. I work at the NASA Johnson Space Center, and I study planetary field geology, so figuring out what we need to do to conduct planetary field geology on other planetary surfaces. I have my bachelor's, master's, and PhD all in geology, bachelor's from Notre Dame and master's and PhD from Arizona State University. My PhD was, again, in using analog sites, or sites that look like other planets, to study processes, scientific processes, and developing technology for the next generation of planetary surface exploration. So I'm going to move to slide three, which shows all of the known planets in our solar system. We've sent missions to each one of these planetary bodies, whether they be orbiters, landers, or rovers, to investigate the processes that shape these planets. If you move to the next slide, slide four, you'll see pictures of each mission, orbiter, landers, rovers, that have gone to all these planetary bodies. You can see that it's slightly out of date as ESA's Rosetta mission ended about a month ago. But this just goes to show all of the efforts that NASA and its international partners have in exploring surface processes on other planets. If you move to slide five, you'll see a brief Apollo history of planetary surface exploration. Apollo represents the only time that human beings have ever set foot on another planetary body, and of course we did this six times with 12 people from 69 to 72. These Apollo astronauts were collecting samples, deploying surface science experiments, and for the final three missions, they also had the lunar roving vehicle, which you can see pictured in the corner of the picture here next to the large outcrop there on Apollo 17. If you move to the next slide, you'll see scientific drivers for planetary exploration. So although the Apollo surface missions made large strides toward understanding the lunar geologic history, a large number of advancements have been made since then. And there are still a large number of outstanding science questions across all of the targets of interest, specifically for human exploration, which I'll spend the remainder of this talk talking about. Across the top of this slide are all potential three target bodies that human beings might visit. Might go back to the moon, as pictured here in a concept sketch from the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter. We also will hopefully have boots on the ground on Mars. Shown here in the picture is the Mars Science Lab Curiosity rover currently driving around on the surface of Mars. And then we also might send humans to small bodies. The OSIRIS-REx mission just launched recently to go and sample an asteroid and return it to Earth. The areas of scientific inquiry for all of these bodies include geology, geophysics, geochemistry, atmospheric science, chemistry as related to life, and all of the investigations of all of these different areas of interest can include varying levels of human interaction. We already have orbiters, landers, and rovers around and on other planetary surfaces, but we hope to send humans there. So what scientific questions can be answered with humans in the loop, and how do we accomplish this? And that's what I'm going to be talking about today. So if you move to the next slide, this sort of sums up what I just said. These are the three potential target destinations for crewed missions, and that includes small bodies going back to the moon and eventually going to Mars. Each one of these destinations introduces complexities from varying communications delays, which get pretty long when you're going to the Martian surface, as well as varying atmospheric and gravity conditions, which impact the way we're going to conduct field science on these planetary bodies. So as we think about developing technology, which I want to talk about today, we want to develop flexible technology that's going to apply in a variety of these scenarios in atmospheric and gravity conditions. If you move to the next slide, it shows the graphic of NASA's journey to Mars. Of course, we start here in low Earth orbit with the International Space Station. We're going to move out potentially with the Orion crew capsule, as well as potentially the asteroid redirect mission that's in the design phases now. And then this all leads toward the journey to Mars, where we hope to one day put astronauts on the surface of Mars. So if you move to the next slide, this shows this plan a different way, which I think is important as we think about the technology development stage of preparing for the journey to Mars. We have the Earth Reliance phase, which is currently underway with the International Space Station and will continue when U.S. private companies continue to provide access to low Earth orbit. We have the proving ground phase, where we test and demonstrate the technologies we need to go to Mars. And then, of course, we have the Earth independent stage, the Mars ready stage, where we're actually going to send people a long way away from our planet out to Mars. So if you move to the next slide, slide 10, we're moving forward from Apollo surface exploration in terms of having humans in space. We have the International Space Station in orbit around Earth right now. It's the size of a football field. You can see it in this picture. We're observing Earth now from ISS. We're conducting science experiments, like you can see in the images. We're preparing for commercial crew. You can see the picture in the top right of Kate Rubens and Jeff Williams looking at one of the crew capsules approaching the ISS. And we're also looking at things like human factors and human health for long-duration space flight using the ISS. So NASA's studying things like crew health. How is their bone density, their eye health going to be affected by living in this environment for the long period of time necessary to get to and from Mars? So if you move to the next slide, on slide 11, we're going to start thinking about moving forward with planetary surface exploration. And what I'm going to talk about today is what we need to do to get ready to send human beings to the destinations I just mentioned. And what you'll hear me saying over and over again is we have to test, redesign, test again, over and over and over again. We need to iterate on these technologies so that we're ready when human beings eventually visit another planetary destination. And this requires an integrated approach. It's not just scientists, it's not just engineers, it's everyone working together in an integrated approach to develop the science concepts, the operational modes that we're going to operate in, as well as the technology we need once we get to the other planet and that will get us there. So if you move to the next slide, this sort of shows what I'm going to be talking about today. I'll talk about integrated operational field tests or analog tests. I'll talk about instrument development. So once we actually put human beings boots on the ground, what are they going to hold in their hands to really do exciting and new science, as well as how we need to train the crew to prepare for an eventual exploration mission. So if you move to the next slide, slide 13, it shows that terrestrial field testing has been a crucial part of planetary surface exploration ever since Apollo. The picture on the left shows the Apollo 17 crew, Jack Schmidt and Gene Cernan, preparing in the desert of Arizona for their mission on Apollo 17, as well as two of NASA's Habitat rovers that were tested in this picture in 2010 to prepare for eventually having astronauts on Mars or the moon. Moving to the next slide, slide 14, shows all of the analog projects that NASA's been involved with most currently and in the last couple years. Definitely not going to talk about all of them because there's certainly a lot to talk about, but I'm going to go over a couple of the analog missions that I've personally worked on and explain how we're preparing for this new generation of surface exploration. And when I say analog tests or operational field tests, I mean a multidisciplinary field test. that allows for early end-to-end testing of both operational concepts, so how we're going to operate once we get to a destination, as well as the hardware needed, and it tests these things together in a real operational environment. And we really make an effort to evaluate these objectives that map to specific technology gaps or knowledge gaps, both in science, operations, and technology. If you move to the next slide, slide 15, I want to introduce the Desert RAS Field Test, and RAS is Research and Technology Studies. The Desert RAS Field Test comprise an integrated team of, like I said, engineers and scientists that span multiple agencies, education centers, academic institutions, even the military, as well as commercial and international partners. We're trying to test and validate hardware and software, as well as mission operations concepts to identify where we are now and where we need to be when we finally visit another planetary surface. And this picture is, like we like to call it, the 2010 Desert RAS family photo. You can see all of the technology assets that were tested in that year. You have habitat rovers, as well as a habitat laboratory for astronauts to conduct in-situ scientific analyses in. So moving to the next slide, slide 16, I go over the technology that we tested in the Desert RAS mission. We, of course, had the habitat rovers. The idea here is that multiple people could live in one of these habitat rovers for a couple weeks at a time. The Desert RAS 2010 mission had two crew members per rover, one astronaut and one field geologist, to test these technologies and operational concepts. We also had sample collection technology, so evaluating, moving forward from the technologies we had in Apollo, what we might need for future exploration. And we also had a habitat laboratory. You can actually see the rovers can dock to the edge of the habitat lab and allow the astronauts to move in, live in, and work inside of this habitat lab to explore the samples that they collected on that mission. Moving to the next slide, slide 17, you see the operations concepts tested in Desert RAS. The biggest one is that we had integrated EVA science operations, EVA meaning extravehicular activity. So every time an astronaut goes boots on the ground and does a spacewalk, they're conducting an EVA. And what Desert RAS was doing was examining the operational concepts, the CONOPs, that enable this complex interaction between Mission Control Center back in Houston, as well as the astronaut crew who's living in the rover. And Desert RAS specifically tested this communication structure over varying communication delays. So whereas the communication delays between here and the moon are negligible, as you move to the Martian surface, you're going to have quite a communications lag between mission control and the crew. Understanding how science information is passed back and forth real time over this delay is really important, and it's something we investigated in Desert RAS. We also had sample collection and curation procedures. Once an astronaut was EVA, how did they collect samples and store them for return to Earth? And we also studied crew training, which I'm going to talk about at the end of the talk. Moving to the next slide, we actually see that we are doing real science. We were testing in the San Francisco volcanic field north of Flagstaff, Arizona. It's a good analog site for a lot of sites you see on the moon and Mars. We were in real time collecting samples and mapping the area to understand the volcanic history of the region. And since then, we've also conducted follow-up science. Just about 3 weeks ago, I was out following the traverses we took in 2010 with geophysical instrumentation to use seismometers, ground penetrating radar, and magnetometers to understand the subsurface structure of the area we traversed over in Desert RAS. Moving on to the next slide, slide 19, I introduced the NEMO analog project. So moving on from Desert RAS, NEMO is the NASA Extreme Environments Mission Operations Field Test. Crew members can live in the Aquarius reef space, shown in the picture on the top right. We just completed NEMO 21 over the summer. It was a 16-day mission with an international crew. There were six crew members over the period of 16 days. And there were numerous participating organizations that you can see here. The objectives were to live in the habitat and conduct simulated EVAs outside to investigate the coral colonies in the surrounding area. Moving to the next slide, on slide 20, I show the science objectives that we were accomplishing during NEMO. We incorporated authentic science with the help of the coral team from FIU, Florida International University. We built coral nurseries at 50 and 90 feet around Aquarius reef space to understand how different types of corals grow at those different depths to evaluate how we might start to repopulate corals around the world. We also conducted follow-up science from the NEMO 20 mission from 2015, And we explored and collected new coral samples for the coral scientists to study. Moving to the next slide, on slide 21, we tested multiple operational concepts at NEMO. As with RAS, we tested the integrated EDA science operations and looked at multiple operational concepts over varying time delays. For the bulk of the mission, we had a 15-minute one-way communication time, which means that when we in mission control sent a message to the crew, the soonest we would hear back from them would be 30 minutes later. So we were interacting with an integrated science team of coral experts. We also tested navigation, map, and traverse planning technologies and operational concepts, as well as joint robotic EDA operations. To do this, I'll move to the next slide, slide 22, and talk about NEMO technology that we tested this last year. We had digital cue cards using an underwater iPad to show procedures and traverse plans for the crew real-time on EDA. We used an IV, or intravehicular activity, support system. So while two crew members would be out on EDA, one crew member would be supporting them from inside the habitat and be able to help them through the EDA as mission control was a 30-minute round-trip delay away. We also tested new science sampling tools in the geology sampling kit that you can see pictured here. Moving to the next slide, slide 23, I'm going to move on from analog integrated testing and talk to you about, once you're actually boots on the ground on another planetary surface, what are the instruments that we actually want to put in astronauts' hands to enable them to have a higher resolution look at the rocks that they're investigating. So moving to the next slide, slide 24, I want to briefly go over what we mean when we say field portable instruments. So the goal of any instrument here is to maximize science return, really enable astronauts to get the best possible scientific data real time on another planetary surface, while increasing or at least not detracting from the efficiency of a real-time EDA scenario. EDAs are strictly planned and they're limited in time because of the consumables and, oxygen and food and everything that astronauts need to operate on another planetary surface. So we want these instruments to not put a wrench in the works, but to actually increase the efficiency of understanding the scientific context of an area of interest. So these instruments influence sample collection, and that they can help an astronaut if they have, say, 10 samples they've collected, but they only have room for 5 to bring back. These instruments can help high-grade those samples to figure out which 5 they want to return to Earth. And they can also influence in-situ data analysis that might inform what an astronaut does next on their traverse. Moving to the next slide, on slide 25, I want to briefly talk about the SERDI team that I'm a part of, as is Laura Bleacher, who will be talking to you after me. We're part of the RISE SERDI team, or the Remote In-Situ and Synchrotron Studies for Science and Exploration team. PI'd out of Stony Brook University, but we have participation from a number of institutions around the country. And we're funded through the Solar System Exploration Research Virtual Institute, which combines science and human exploration objectives. So I want to talk to you about our objectives of specifically the field team. So I'll move to the next slide on slide 26. For the field work incorporated with the RISE project, we first start with a science question. We want to answer a new and exciting and compelling science question. Then we identify a suite of field portable instruments that make sense to address this science question. We want to evaluate the role that these instruments might play in in-situ analysis to answer these questions. And then finally, we want to provide recommendations to the human exploration community for how you might incorporate these instruments into an operational concept, as well as think about what technology needs to be developed for future missions to Mars, the Moon, or small bodies. Next slide, slide 27, actually shows our field structure. And Laura's going to stay on after I get off, and I'm sure she'd be willing to take questions about this as she was heavily involved with planning and execution of the field campaign. So here's sort of what our field teams look like in the field. We have a simulated astronaut crew. In this case, we had a crew of 3 with 2 field geologists and 1 astronaut from the Johnson Space Center. We had a number of instrument teams that I'll talk about here in a minute. So each instrument team consisted of 2 scientists to operate the instrument and feed the data taken from these instruments into the ongoing EDA that the crew was completing. And we also had something really unique and exciting in that we brought science journalism students out in the field with us. So Laura was heavily involved in this project. We brought students from Stony Brook University out in the field with us, and they were able to embed in our active field research team real time. They were out with us the entire campaign, and they learned what it was like to actually be embedded in a scientific field campaign. We were actually able to travel up to Stony Brook ahead of time. They were able to come down to the Goddard Space Flight Center to understand how science journalism works from inside NASA. Moving to the next slide, on slide 28, I show the field site that we operate in on the Big Island of Hawaii. We work in the southwest rift zone of the Kilauea volcano. You can actually see in the bottom right corner a picture of the lava flow that we work on. In the top right of that picture, you can actually see the Kilauea caldera, that large circle at the top of the image. The dark flow that the yellow arrows are pointing to is actually the flow that we work on, and it was erupted from those fissures that are outlined by the red lines on the picture. So what RISE is doing is using these instruments to study the physical volcanology, how the flow is in place, as well as the chemistry and the mineralogy of both the flow itself and any alteration products that form on the top of the flow. Moving to the next slide, on slide 29, I introduce why this flow was selected. We picked the December 1974 flow as an analog due to its the fact that it's a desert environment with brief damp periods. So it looks like what we think the surface of, for example, Mars might look like. There's alteration on the surface of the flow that results from the active Kilauea plume coming from the caldera on the last slide that interacts with the lava flow itself. If you look in the back of this image, you can actually see sort of a reddish-brown plume coming up from the horizon. That's the plume coming up from the active Kilauea caldera. It comes downslope toward us in the picture, and when it rains, this gaseous plume actually interacts with the surface of the flow and creates these interesting alteration products that we're using the field portable instruments to study. The 74 flow also has basaltic flows that are interspersed with basaltic ash and eroded basaltic sediment, like similar to what we see on other planetary surfaces. And also similar is the low slope morphology that we see elsewhere. So all these reasons combine into why we selected this flow as an analog site. Moving to the next slide, on slide 30, I show pictures of all the field instruments that we tested as part of the RISE field campaign. We have broad field of view instruments that are sort of standoff. The theory is here that in the desert raft concept that I mentioned earlier, you as an astronaut would roll up in your rover and initiate these instrument measurements before you got out of the rover to conduct your EVA. So we had a multispectral imager as well as a LIDAR, which gives surface texture information about the outcrop. So you collect these images ahead of time as an overlay for all the other data that you collect while you're on the EVA. We also had ground-penetrating radar, which probes the subsurface. And we had instruments for in-situ chemistry and mineralogy, like an X-ray fluorescence spectrometer, which you can see in the lower left, and an X-ray diffraction instrument, which you can see in the bottom middle picture, that give chemistry and mineralogy. Finally, we had a kite to provide airborne data for site context. UAVs are not allowed on the Big Island of Hawaii, as well as in all national parks, so we actually use a kite to provide the aerial imagery to give the astronauts some context over the area they're exploring. The next slide, slide 31, shows some of the data that we've collected with these instruments. The types of things that we're investigating at the 74 flow are the alteration coatings that I mentioned form as a result of this volcanic plume and the flow itself. And we use those in-situ chemistry and mineralogy instruments, as well as the multispectral image, to investigate what these coatings look like. Do they vary along the length of the flow? What are they made out of? How do they form? And might we see them on other planetary surfaces? You can actually see some data here on the left, the picture on the left, from the handheld X-ray fluorescence instrument. We also have a Solfatara site at 74, which is very similar to sites the rovers have seen on the Martian surface. Solfatara sites result from when there's latent heat sticking around. There's still heat coming up on the Big Island of Hawaii. That then interact with the younger flows that are sitting on the surface and create these really high sulfur alteration products on the surface. And you can see some multispectral imaging work from the lab in the middle picture here. And we also investigate flow morphology and how the flow is in place. The picture on the right is, I think, a really neat image, and it's a picture from the kite that I mentioned. In the middle, in the top half of the picture, you can see a lighter toned sort of circle sticking out, and it's surrounded by the dark black of the 74 flow. That little circle actually represents the older flows that the 74 flow came in on top of. You can use images like the kite to figure out how this new flow was in place, how it interacted with the terrain underneath it. I think this picture really shows that. So the next slide, slide 32, we want to answer these science questions, yes, but we also want to think about the operational considerations of using these instruments. So while we've shown that we actually really do have increased science value from using these instruments in the field, we want to think operationally about what effect incorporating these instruments have on the overall EDA timeline. So what RISE is doing is building off of the old Desert Rats heritage to look at these operational timelines. And I'll show you an example of that. You move to the next slide on slide 33. This shows a geologic map of the Desert Rats 2010 test area. So each one of those colors represents a different unit that the science team picked out ahead of time before the rovers got to the field site, just using Google Earth images. What the black diamonds represent is a sample that was picked up by one crew during Desert Rats 2010. So there are there are 10 diamonds there that each represent a different sample. In the field, it was really hard to tell these samples apart. If you had an unlimited time as a field geologist in this area, you would be able to pick one out from the other, and that's because you do have unlimited time and resources relative to what you have in a planetary exploration environment. However, on RAPS, we were having EDAs that were sometimes as short as 25 minutes, which is just really not enough time to really dwell on a sample and think, hey, how does this sample correlate to one I saw the day before or even several days before? What field portable instruments give you is the ability to interrogate at a higher resolution the geochemistry of an area and record these data so you can compare one day's data to the next. And as a field geologist, it's really valuable in these limited time, limited consumable constraints to be able to tie scientific observations together with ones you made days before. So you can see the darker flow that's sort of on the bottom left-hand corner of this picture. That's the ST crater flow. That's very visually distinct. It's a lot younger than the flows and volcanoes around it. It's really visually distinct even in the field. There were three samples collected from ST, as indicated by the three diamonds around that cone in the flow, that were very easy to tell apart in the field real time. However, the other seven samples, it was really challenging with the amount of time we had left to tell them apart. So if you move to the next slide on slide 34, this shows handheld X-ray fluorescence data, which gives chemistry, that isolates these 10 samples into different groups. And you can clearly see that three distinct units are pulled out from this handheld X-ray fluorescence data. And if you move to the next slide on slide 35, you actually show when you put these back on the map, the blue circles correspond to those three samples I mentioned came from the ST crater flow. So you can clearly see that there's that the two samples taken that are indicated by the red circles actually indicate that there's a different volcanic flow flowing off to the west of ST crater. And just because of the limited time we had, we as the crew were not able to pick up this flow in real time. But having these handheld X-ray fluorescence data enabled us to identify that there are more flows in this area. And had we known that real time during Desert Rats, we might have attempted to do more EDAs off to the west of ST to collect more samples from this different unit for return to Earth. Operationally, however, every time you take a handheld X-ray fluorescence measurement, it costs you 2 minutes of time. So that's 1 minute, that's the actual integration time of the instrument. It's the time that you need to hold the instrument against the rock itself. But you also need an additional minute to document that data. Take pictures of the rocks that you sampled. Note it in your field notebook, or in the case of Desert Rats, as we couldn't have a notebook, we actually talked out loud and recorded it about the sample description and the site context. So every time you get one of those numbers with the XRF, it costs you 2 minutes of time. And that doesn't sound like a lot, but the Apollo EDAs are only 8 hours long, and they had a lot of ground to cover. You want to think about, as a crew member, the cost versus the science value added of each one of these instruments. And these are the types of lessons learned that we're trying to pull out with the RISE field test. So if you move to the next slide, on slide 36, I want to talk about some final thoughts about the portable instruments before I move on. So through the RISE project, we've identified that these field portable instruments are highly beneficial. They both help you high-grade your samples and figure out which samples you want to bring back for return to Earth, as well as getting real-time contextual insights. In the case of RAS, that was identifying a flow that we weren't necessarily able to pick out without the instrument. However, selecting an instrument suite is non-trivial and should be a priority in mission planning, regardless of which destination we end up visiting. And through RISE, work is ongoing to investigate how these field portable instruments might fit into a future EDA operational concept, but we have to continue testing them in relevant field environments to continue to pull out these lessons learned and figure out what technology we need to work on now. Moving to the next slide on slide 37, The last thing I want to talk about is now that we've talked about sort of an integrated testing approach with all of the technology and operational concepts you need for planetary surface exploration, then move down into once you're on an EVA, what instruments do you need to conduct science on another planet? We want to talk about the people who are going to be using those instruments, the astronaut crew who are going to take the scientific instruments we're working on and actually deploy them in the field, and that feeds forward into a successful exploration mission. So if you flip to the next slide, slide 38, I show some context of the science training history of the Apollo astronauts. We like to say that for every Apollo astronaut that flew to the surface of the moon, they had the equivalent of a master's degree in geology. They had hundreds of hours of classroom training and of field training. From the top left picture, you can actually see one of the geo trainers training the astronaut and training them in the geologic math of the sites they're going to visit during Apollo, as well as working them into the traverse plan so they feel comfortable with what they'd be executing on the lunar surface. In the lower left, you see one of the field trips that the Apollo astronauts went on with field geologists to teach them about interpreting rocks in real time. The picture on the right shows a document that was produced, you can look up if you're interested, that documents everything I've just said, how the Apollo astronauts were trained and why, and which field sites they went to. Moving to the next slide on slide 39, we have a current look at the astronaut training. So for every astronaut that's selected, they go through a two-year candidacy phase where they're designated astronaut candidate. And they get trained in a whole host of things, including International Space Station operations, how to do an EVA on ISS. They learn how to stay alive in space for long periods of time. They get health training. They get human factors training all over a period of 2 years. They also get geology and science training. And that includes, just like Apollo, they get classroom training, like you can see in the lower left, where they learn about the fundamentals of geology, of Earth science, and of planetary science. And then, you can see in the upper left, we take them in the field. Again, it's trained field geologists with these astronauts to teach them how geologists and scientists do work in the field. In the upper right, you see another phase of astronaut training. Once the astronaut candidates have graduated and they're full astronauts that are able to be assigned to a flight, we run them through, we give them the option to be run through field assistant training. So every time that there is a field geologist connected with the program who has a field campaign, they can actually take an astronaut with them in the field to embed them in our field campaign, similar to the science journalist from RISE. This picture is a picture of Don Pettit out just 3 weeks ago, as I mentioned, in the Desert Raft 2010 Traverse follow-up project. He's deploying seismometers in the ST crater area. And finally, in the lower right, astronauts actually take part in these analog missions that I mentioned earlier. This picture is Chell Lindgren in the Desert Raft 2011 field test, and Chell since then has flown a six-month mission to the International Space Station. We also recently, just this summer, had a couple astronauts as part of the NEMO crew. And it's a great way for these astronauts to learn how to do science in a real operational environment. So next slide, slide 40, I show a picture that sort of is a result of this crew training. So this is an actively erupted volcano in Russia, and a crew member on ISS actually took this picture, and they flew over this erupting volcano on one orbit of ISS and said, you know, hey, that looks like a volcano that I'm not sure, you know, really anybody else knows is erupting. And the next time ISS came around, he had his camera ready and snapped this picture. And pictures like this really enable volcanologists who study active eruptions like this to better understand and get a better look at how these eruptions happen and what the dynamics of them are. And it's because these astronauts understand what the process is, what's important about it, and they can document and observe and let the crew on the ground know that these eruptions are going on. So moving to the next slide, slide 41. I think I'm preaching to the choir here, but there's a lot of value in terms of exploration. These are all pictures from, of course, the Apollo 11 lunar landing, the first boot print made in the lunar soil. And we also have a crowd of over 10,000 people watching this landing in Central Park in New York. So a lot of people watched this landing even back in the 60s, and I think people are just as excited about it today. So I'll show you the next slide, slide 42, almost done. We have sort of, this is, you know, today's NASA. And that is the NASA that's exploring low Earth orbit and hoping to eventually go on the journey to Mars. So I took the picture on the upper right, and this is from a launch just on October 17th of a Cygnus launch, so one of these private companies that's launching resupplies to the International Space Station. There's a NASA picture on the left of the launch, and on the right, that bright dot you see in the middle of the image is the picture of the launch from my apartment in Washington, D.C. And the rooftop of my apartment building was packed with people watching NASA TV and watching the launch. So people are still really excited about it. And Elon Musk in charge of SpaceX, I'm sure you guys all know, he's planning on sending the Dragon capsule to the Martian surface here, and I think it's really captivating a lot of the American public. So finally, on the last slide, I just want to say thank you guys for having me. And if anybody has any questions that listening to this recorded later, please feel free to email me. My email address is on the slide. And thanks for having me, and I'll take questions.
Thanks, Kelsey. That was a great talk, and I know we had to go really fast, and I don't want to hold you, so just cut us off whenever.
Oh, no, I still have a few minutes. Yeah.
Okay. but while people are unmuting their phones, I just had a couple questions of my own just to start off. And just from your experience with all the analogs, I'm most curious in what do you think are the biggest takeaways from each of the challenges? Like, for example, when you guys were simulating the communications delay, or you were testing all the equipment, what are some of the biggest takeaways that you and insights that you gathered from doing all these analog tests?
Yeah, thanks. Great question. So one thing that actually is pretty recent and fresh in my mind is that for NEMO 21, just this past summer, I was helping out as best I could, and one of the roles that I had was the science communicator. So when the crews were on EVA, underwater looking at these corals, I was interfacing between the coral scientist sitting next to me and the crew on EVA, really doing the science. And so with this 30-minute time delay, the coral scientist would say, oh, wow, there's a coral that I could see in their helmet camera that they just passed that we'd really like to sample. But by the time my communication would get to them, they would be long gone from that site, right? So this communication delay, you think about stressing the communication structures and the technologies, but actually from a science perspective, from conducting science and getting really valuable data and samples out of it, having a really highly trained crew is crucial. And so what the crew kept saying was, we want more before we, launch on one of these missions. We want to understand how to think like you guys. We want to understand exactly what we're looking for so we can be your ambassadors. And I think these communication delays really stress that point. It's crucial to have a crew that can say, this coral is what these scientists are looking for, or this rock is exactly what those geologists back on Earth would want. And so crew training came up a lot, and, we had a lot of fun, and I know the crew had a lot of fun learning all about coral. I certainly learned a lot about it. But that was sort of one thing that came up again and again, and I think the whole team felt the same way.
Great. I know because you said they pretty much got a master's level of education in geology. Did they actually get a master's? I mean, I'm just curious.
I don't think so. 11 of the 12 people that flew were pilots, so they didn't come from a scientific background. On Apollo 17, Jack Schmidt was a geologist and had a PhD in geology, so he's the exception. But they knew quite a lot about both specifically their field site. Their field trips were tailored toward the specific site they were visiting, so they really understood the features they were going to see, and they had a lot of classroom training to back it up.
So I guess NASA doesn't have an accreditation to give out degrees or anything, huh?
I should really look into that.
and I love all the pictures that you're and people should interrupt me if I'm blabbing too much if they have questions. But I love all the pictures. Is there a specific gallery or I should just go to the websites, or I should send them to the websites if they want all the pictures?
Yes, there is. Actually, NASA has sort of a centrally located site for analogs, and you can search it if you just Google NASA analogs. And it actually has all of these analogs that I'm talking about. It's got RAS, it's got NEMO. I flipped through the NEMO pictures just to make this talk, and I was really having trouble picking them. So there's a lot of really great photos. RISE also has a website, and if you Google RISE, RISE4E, you can actually go to the website of the team that Laura and I are both a part of to get pictures from us.
Okay.
And one other thing that I think Laura can elaborate on, too, is that the science journalists produced a really amazing website that's reportingrise.com. So reporting RISE, RISE4E, that has sort of the reports and articles that they produced, both from interviewing us scientists before we left in the field and after we got back. So that has a lot of field photos and some interesting science journalism student articles.
Great. And then I just had a question for you, since your background is in geology. If you could go to, say, Moon or Mars or an asteroid, I mean, which one do you think is the most geologically rich in terms of science?
Well, I love them all. If they're going to send me somewhere, I'll happily hop on the rocket, regardless of where it's going. I think there are a lot of really compelling science questions about at all three of them. I think, you know, Apollo and studying the sample since Apollo has raised some really rich lunar questions that I would love to go back to the moon to sample. For my PhD, I studied impact craters, and there's one of the biggest on the far side of the moon that I'd love to visit. I think there's a lot of questions about small bodies, asteroids, about the early solar system formation. And, of course, Mars is sort of, it's a known and an unknown, right? We know a lot about it, but everything we learn more about it raises different and more compelling science questions. So I can't pick a favorite.
Okay. What are the NASA plans for going back to the moon? I always get different answers from different people, and I don't know if you've heard anything.
Yeah, I think it's constantly evolving, but we currently have the Artemis mission on the books to go back to the asteroid redirect mission, and that's to send a robotic mission to an asteroid, get a sample, bring it closer to the moon, and then send human beings to that sample in orbit around the moon to conduct science, small body science. So the Artemis mission is still on the books, and that, of course, involves lunar orbit. So that's sort of where the plans are right now, but they're constantly evolving, and, of course, today's election day, so we'll have to see.
Right, that's right.
But I should probably sign off and leave you with Laura. And Laura's been intimately involved with many of the things that I talked about today, so I'm sure she is more than capable to answer any remaining questions.
Sure, and we appreciate that you put your contact info at the end of that slide. So
yes,
so thank
definitely.
You for that.
Please email me. Yep.
Okay. Thanks, Kelsey.
Thank you, and thanks, Laura.
Yep. No problem.
Laura, I'm not sure if you had anything in particular to add to Kelsey's talk or anything before we just jump into questions, because I have a whole list, honestly.
Oh, okay. So Kelsey did mention the website that was put together by the journalism students that we worked with on the last Rise Build campaign. I don't know if she actually mentioned the URL, though. That URL is reportingrise4e.com. With NASA, we like acronyms. So RISE, again, as she mentioned earlier, is an acronym. So it's reportingrise4e.com. And there you can find tons of information, the last field campaign that happened about a year and a half ago. And we are going to be doing another field campaign this coming late spring, early summer, probably in early June. And this field campaign will actually take place in New Mexico. And we'll be using a lot of the same science instruments that we used and having a lot of the same team members, a few new ones that we had this last go-round. But we'll be working with a whole new slew of journalism students. So they'll be putting out some additional products and kind of adding to the work that the previous students did, kind of documenting the science and field work that Kelsey and her team have been doing. So definitely stay tuned for that. Another way to follow along with the work that NASA is doing in regards to preparing for human exploration of the solar system beyond low Earth orbit is, of course, the NASA website, which I know can kind of be a bear to navigate. But if you go to nasa.gov/Mars, that's where you can find some links to a lot of the work that we're doing with what we call the Journey to Mars, which Kelsey showed early on in her presentation, a slide or two related to what we call the architecture of our journey to Mars in terms of the various components and you know, testing and things that need to happen both in low Earth orbit and then extending outwards to the vicinity of the moon and then, of course, actually on to Mars and possibly also involving an asteroid. So definitely, you know, stay tuned with the NASA website. Follow along on if you do hashtag Journey to Mars. That's NASA's hashtag that we're using to share with the public on social media the different steps that we're taking to prepare for human exploration. So those are some great ways to follow along.
Thanks, Laura. And I had more questions about the journalism project. If, you know, museums are or planetariums are paired with a university, you're talking about journalism students. Is that right?
Yep. These are primarily undergrad students that we worked with and that we will be working with again this time and a couple of graduate students who kind of work with their professors to act as mentors for the undergrads.
And is that a closed application process if people are interested or?
So we have a specific partner with this program, and it's the Stony Brook School of Journalism. And the reason for that is that the principal investigator, so the person who leads the overall RISE team, is Dr. Tim Glotch, who is a professor at Stony Brook University. And so Stony Brook University has a very good journalism program, and they also have an organization called the Alan Alda Center for Communicating Science. So as a whole, they're very dedicated to science communication, both science writing as well as science journalism, as well as helping train scientists, engineers, and managers to be effective public speakers in terms of sharing either the science work that they do or the work of their organization. So we're specifically partnered with them, you know, but we're definitely open to talking with others who might be interested in learning more about this program and how they might replicate it within their organizations.
Great. All right. Let's see. Any other questions for speakers or for Laura? Well, okay. I'm happy to close out early. Laura, thank you so much for coming and filling this time and getting us Kelsey and for all the great work that you do.
No problem. It's my pleasure. And I just want to, you know, thank you and also thank all of the listeners today for the great work that you do in sharing science with the public. We really appreciate it. And it's hard for us to be in lots of different locations around the country and elsewhere. And so we really appreciate the work that you guys do. So thanks again. And, you know, please feel free to contact me as well if there are additional questions that I can answer or additional, you know, resources that I can point anyone to. I'd be happy to do that.
Great. So thank you to everyone for joining us today. This was a great way to get into this whole NASA analog thing. And I'm really interested in seeing where this goes. So just remember to everyone that this talk will be recorded and archived on the Alliance site and on the Solar System Ambassador sites if anyone wants to hear it again or if you want your education staff to listen to it too. As Laura said, you can email us or email Kelsey with any questions you might have. Again, my email address is jnee@jpl.nasa.gov. And remember, on Thursday, we have an Earth Science telecon about mapping rogue methane sources. As always, the most up-to-date information is on our websites. Thank you again, everybody, and have a wonderful day. Don't forget to vote. Bye, Laura.
Thanks.
Bye. Bye, everybody.